Rated T to M.
Sibilance. Sibilance.
This show is about conversation.
Conversations with interesting,
creative people.
Creative,
talented people.
Talented people.
This is Irrational Interviews.
This is Ken Levine.
And I'm Julian Murdoch.
And we call this show Irrational Interviews. So today we get to do something that, for, at least for me, is pretty special. I don't often get a chance to sit down with people who do a job that's extremely similar to my job, and that's creative director and writer. And that's a specific set of tasks that don't really exist outside of the games industry. And today I was fortunate enough to sit down with Amy Hennig from Naughty Dog, who is the creative director over there and also the writer of the Uncharted games. And her career goes back a ways. It's pretty embarrassingly illustrious. And we had a great talk. We sat down and just sort of talked about what our jobs were and what it means to write a video game, which is extremely different from any other media. And we're still figuring that out. And join us today as we try to figure that out.
Thanks for taking some time today. I wanted to kick this off by really talking about process a little bit. I was thinking about the opportunity to talk to both of you at the same time, and it occurred to me both of you actually kind of started your careers at least thinking about film, right, as writers, and then sort of ended up as creative directors of these sort of big story-driven AAA titles. And maybe, Amy, I'll just start with you. Do you think that there's something unique about being a writer driving the creative process in a video game, and how does that change how you go about game development?
I think there is definitely something unique, and I think both Ken and I are in sort of an unusual position of being in some sort of a creative leadership role and also being the writer. I have a lot of writer friends in the industry, and they're usually contracted, or their role is writer and someone else is the creative director, and so that gives us a lot of latitude that some other people don't have. I actually didn't come about my career from a writing perspective. I was an English major, and I did go to film school for a couple of years. But I started off as an artist and an animator, and it wasn't until a few years into my career that I actually had an opportunity to write, and then I guess the rest is history. It's sort of like I just stepped into the role because it was vacant.
Ken, you know, we've talked before about sort of your starting on the TV side of things and on the film side of things. One thought I had was, you know, as you start going through the process of making a game, do you feel pulled in two directions? On the one hand, you're in charge of, you know, the script, right? A key part of a big story-based game. On the other hand, you're also kind of in charge of everything else. How do you balance that?
Well, in the way you balance that, and I imagine Amy feels the same way as you, you bring in good people to remove as much of the burden that you're not absolutely essential for as possible. You know, I'm a much better writer than I am a manager. I don't think I'm a terrific manager. I'm certainly not a good project planner. So I have great people like Emily Brinker and Tim Gerritsen and who really drive that process. And I try to spend as much time focusing on, you know, the creative direction aspect of the job as possible. But even so, I think that it's not as clear as a film director. Our job is still not very well defined, and I'm still trying to figure out exactly where the job begins and where the job ends all the time. I mean, Amy, I don't know how you feel. I don't know if you're in the same spot.
Absolutely. I mean, it's both sort of wonderful and terrible that I think that we're in the positions we are, because it's more work than one person can do. And so like you, yeah, you absolutely have to have a wonderful crew of people around you that are really, you know, handling the nuts and bolts of the game design, which is why we have game directors as well as creative directors, and also, of course, all the practical management of the team, as well as just your fellow team members themselves, which are, you know, working out all the imagined stuff that, you know, that you've all come up with. But I think we're sort of blessed in that we don't have to get a lot of approval or buy-in from any sort of management, because that's us, right? Sort of a nice place to be, and it lets us be nimble, and what's nice about that is I think nimbleness is a requirement of game development, and I think the best games are developed in a very iterative way. It's invention and it's sort of experimentation and engineering. It's not the way films are made, and therefore, because we're in the roles we are, we can sort of event and adapt along with the rest of the game development. And I think that's how you get a better story. Unfortunately, it's also a terrifying process because you're constantly working without a net. You're kind of figuring it out as you go by necessity.
Yeah, I mean, I was watching Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the Fincher's film, last night, and there's just, I remember watching some scene where there's just like a car pulling up to a house, and I'm like, they know enough about their process that they can plan, okay, on Wednesday, June 20th, we're going to do the scene where the car pulls up to the house, and we need these people to do it. I mean, this kind of car, where I think game development is still so fluid and larger. I mean, even the short game is, you know, 7-8 hours of an interactive experience versus, you know, a 2-hour movie. They're so big. And so our responsibility, you know, the responsibility of me or an Amy is to keep the whole arc of that thing in their head. And I think that by necessity, we have to be much more fluid and responsive because there's just no way to plan something that large in the way you can plan a movie.
No, it's impossible. And I wonder if people think that we do, that, you know, that we have some sort of defined pre-production process where we actually write out a script and then we execute on that script and implement against it. And then we polish the thing up. And it's just not the case. When, and maybe I haven't been enough companies. So there are people that are way more organized than I've ever been. But but the point is like, generally, you're in production from day one until the final day. And what that necessitates is, you don't have the luxury to sit back and sort of, you know, chew on the end of your pencil and make everyone wait, because your team is sitting at their desk, ready to go, burning salary, morale dipping, you know.
Yeah.
They need to know what they're working on. And so, you know, we have to make some best guesses and make some initial decisions that we're willing to stick pins in and write around. And I've described this to friends of mine that are actual like screenwriters, and they just think it's absolutely insane that we have to have this sort of holistic mental map and write these things. I mean, I don't know what you do, Ken, but I write it a scene at a time out of sequence over the course of a year.
Yep.
And you have to be able to see the entire web of the project in your head, which is changing from day to day based on production realities and things, and then be able to chase down that web and immediately go, we got to go this way. That won't work. This will work. And so what it does is it means development, and the writing turns into a massive and sort of communal act of faith, which is a hard thing to sustain in a developer, I think.
You know, you talked about act of faith and out of sequence. And I think there's part of that act of faith is the faith you have to put in yourself, because that sounds like you have the same kind of experience. Like, I'll write a scene like, you know, like the Andrew Ryan scene in Bioshock 1 before I've written most of the game. And because of the animation requirements of it, because it's a big animated scene, so we had to get started on it very early. Mm-hmm. I really don't exactly know how the hell I'm going to get to that. Like, how I'm going to build up to that scene. I don't know where I'm exactly going after that scene, but that scene is going to be set in stone to some degree because of the animation requirements of it. So you kind of have to, you have to trust yourself too, to like be like, okay, this is going to, I'm going to figure this out somehow, you know?
Right. That's what I mean. It's an act of faith on the individual level. And then it's one that you're asking the team to extend back to you, and that you're extending back to them as well. I mean, it's a collaborative act of faith within the entire team, but the hard thing is, and I don't know, you might be a more confident writer than I am, but to be honest, the most talented people I've ever met in my life actually secretly think that they're absolute frauds, and they have no idea how they've accomplished what they've accomplished and how they'll ever do it again. And my God, someday they're all going to find out and I'll be ruined, right? And the thing is I think you get to a certain point in your life and a certain age, and I'm in my late 40s now, where you've pulled it off enough times, and it is an absolute intellectual act of faith saying, I don't feel like I have the faith in myself, but intellectually I know that I've always managed to solve these problems, and therefore I have to get comfortable with being uncomfortable, and I have to ask the entire team to get comfortable with being uncomfortable and trust me, even though I'm not even sure I trust myself. And I think it's just the nature of the beast.
Do you find that people, like especially the more junior people on the team, come in expecting that there's a much clearer, much more organized process than there actually is, and they kind of get a little panicky during the course of the project because they realize that game development sort of is operating without a net? Have you had that experience?
Yeah, but I think it depends on the person. It's not even based necessarily on experience or youth. I think some people are way more comfortable in a structured environment. And frankly, that's something we try to weed out in the interview process at Naughty Dog, and we don't hire them. That's going to be an issue because this whole company is organized chaos. I mean, we've always operated without producers, and that's not meant as a pejorative against producers. It's just kind of the way we grew up. And, you know, from a company of a handful of people to one where that's, you know, almost 200. And we just sort of loosely plan what we're doing, because that's the best you can do with something that's as iterative and experimental as what we do. And we adapt and we trust each other's experience to know that we're going to make the wisest, most pragmatic decisions we can while still trying to keep the quality of the product and stay inspired. So I think people get here and they realize pretty quick that that's the world they're living in, and they're either going to stick with it or they're not. But yeah, I think it's tough. In the same way that, you know, you as an individual can look back at your own work and say, well, look, I don't know how I'm going to solve this, and right now it feels hopeless, but I felt like that before lots of times, and I always figured it out. And I think you can also, if you've worked with a team long enough, they'll also extend that same courtesy back to you. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think we all, you know, especially developers who've been around a long time, you kind of have to rely upon that objective analysis of yourself, because subjectively it often feel that you don't know how you're going to solve something. And you need to be able to step back and say, like, look, I've been in worse places before. I'm going to figure out a way to solve it. You know, I have no idea what that is. And I think people also underestimate how flexible stories are in terms of problem solving. I think people think that stories are a lot more rigid than they actually are. I think once you do
absolutely. Actually, I've always said it has to be the most flexible part of the development process.
It's the easiest thing to change to some degree. You know, you can be much more adaptive. You know, you have a scene that's already written and recorded and animated, and then something needs to change. The easiest thing to change is, you know, change something in the story.
Exactly, that hasn't been written yet. And so, which is the very reason to not say, here's my 300-page script, let's go make it, because within 5 minutes, it's out of date.
Yeah.
It's not going to be accurate anymore as we make decisions about the game and cut levels and change what connects to what and how long certain things are going to take and what we have time to do asset-wise. And so that's why you give yourself a roadmap, and then you're sort of fleshing out that roadmap as you go and adapting your dialogue and your scenes and what your expectations for the story are based on what the rest of the team can accomplish.
It's interesting you guys both use sort of the word iterative. You talk about leaving a lot of things on the cutting room floor, as it were, for practical reasons. You know, you have some level that you want to design and it ends up just not working. But by the same token, Ken, you mentioned, you know, working with a screenplay, you've got sort of a 2-hour block. You know, you're going from point A to point B. Screenplays are generally pretty well structured, 124 pages, 3 or 5 act structure, et cetera. When you sit down to make a game, it could be 7 hours or it could be 50 hours. How do you self-edit the stuff that does work? Meaning, you know, not because you wanted a mechanic that you can't get in the game in time, but just because you start realizing it doesn't work from a story perspective because you don't have that artificial constraint. How do you make sure that what goes out is actually good and self-edited?
There's two questions there. One is, how do you structure something where you don't know how long it's going to be? To me, the structure remains very similar because I have no idea how long a game is going to be when I start working on it. But basically, I generally work in games from a 3-act structure because probably that's where I came from. And it's a fairly natural beginning, middle, and end kind of structure. And you just need to know that you have this rough skeleton of something that you keep turning back to, which is saying, okay, the character has to get somewhere and they have to get somewhere here. They have to have a change in their plans here. And the character has to develop. I think that's the most important thing that, you know, I took out of writing movies, is that stories are about characters changing. And most games probably, you know, don't even start really with the notion that there is a character. And sometimes, you know, even the games I work on, you know, who's the character in Bioshock? Is it Jack? Probably not. I mean, he doesn't really, you know, there's not a lot to him. So it's who's changing and what's changing and how's the story evolving. But that could be, that doesn't really matter if it's, you know, 7 hours or 15 hours.
Actually, the irony is I find that even when we're telling a 10 or 12 hour story, ostensibly, there's not enough time to get done what you want to do when you think actually there should be a luxury of time based just purely on the math. But so much of what we do has to sort of service the gameplay. And we're sometimes just shoehorning in exposition or some sort of character moment that we feel like needs to be in there, but there's really no room for it in the midst of all the gunplay and punching and things.
You can't take for granted how patient your audience is going to be with your storytelling, and that's why we tend to use the visual space. We haven't until now have had the advantage of actors as charming as... Now, there's anything wrong with our actors. We just didn't give them the opportunity to be as charming as the ensemble that Amy's put together. So we've really had to do a lot of our storytelling in the visual space. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, we're working, you know, with actors who are quite charming and quite appealing. And that's a huge advantage because, you know, they can just do a lot of the work for you. But you can't run, you know, here you go when you watch Apocalypse Now or something, and you can put Brando and Martin Sheen in a room for literally 20 minutes, and there's maybe 30 lines of dialogue, you know, in that whole sequence. And obviously there's no gameplay that they have to worry about. So we have to work in an extremely, as game writers, in extremely, extremely compressed format. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I interviewed a writer who I hired the first full-time writer besides myself a couple weeks ago, Drew. And, you know, one of the reasons I hired him is I said, what's the most important part about being a game writer? And his answer was brevity. And and I was like, okay, you're hired.
Yeah, I mean, otherwise it starts feeling really self-indulgent. And I think that's one of the trickiest balancing acts with what we do. And I've said this before, is it's really not about control. It's about humility and being able to look at your own work with humility, and especially when, like, working with the actors or working with the team. Nobody wants to work with a dictator, and you're usually not going to do particularly good work if you're just, you know, dig your heels in and you're intractable. On the other hand, you don't want to be so egoless that you let people walk all over you, and not even in a way that's meant to be adversarial, but just there's lots of ideas out there, and you're going to have to kind of judge them on their quality as well as ideas from the actors and say, yes, do that, or like, no, there's a reason I wrote it this way, let's do that. And you have to be able to make those sort of egoless calls on a dime. And, you know, I think that relates to what you're saying is, you know, what they always say, right? Kill your darlings, kill your babies when you're a writer, is you have to be able to look at your own work and say, this part's self-indulgent. This joke doesn't need to be there. You know, I could do this in a much less flowery way and know that it's going to be better for that.
I think that, you know, what Amy talks about, ego is critically important. And to some degree, I think there's a skill you have to develop, which is the ability to be the audience, not just the writer, and to look at what you're doing and saying, to remove yourself from the emotion of writing it, which is often a complicated, messy thing, and it's a process I hate because I'm constantly judging myself, and it's probably the most unpleasant thing I do.
I don't know any writers who like writing. I only know writers who like having written.
Yes.
Right?
I think there are people, like, I was watching a documentary on Woody Allen, and if you saw that one on PBS...
I haven't.
Basically, Woody Allen's a guy who just sits down. He never has writer's block. He enjoys writing, and that's why he's so prolific, right? He just sits down and he just has more ideas than he can possibly do, and he just writes and writes and writes and writes, and he enjoys it, and he loves it, and he doesn't seem to judge himself. And boy,
that must be nice.
Yeah, that must be great. I find it to be a miserable, depressing process, but afterwards, it's the best thing ever because you have this script and I wrote that stuff, but
And the moment when it starts to flow, and some of the emotional aspects of writing I tend to hold close to my vest just only because it seems so, I don't know, airy-fairy or something. But it's like there's a moment when everything starts to flow that almost feels magical. And waiting for that moment to hit is awful. Having that moment hit can be wonderful. It usually hits at about 3:30 in the morning, and so you don't know how to judge what you're writing, whether it's just the euphoria of getting something on the page, and then you're going to look at it in the morning and go, oh my God, what have I done? But there is something very mysterious about the process. And again, that's why it's hard to then have a team of 100 people saying, hey, the process is really mysterious. Don't get on my, get off my back. You know, it's like, you don't know how long it's going to take to figure something out. And then when you compound that, getting back to your very initial question, Julian, is that, you compound that with the fact that most of your day is taken up with other stuff that has to get done, and all of a sudden you look at the clock, 7 o'clock, and you're only starting on your own work now. And you need uninterrupted time to do it. You can't say, oh good, I got 15 minutes, I can bang out some writing, I can figure something out in 15 minutes. It just doesn't work that way. So it's kind of a painful process, and you have to just keep coming at it from different angles, I find. And part of that sort of, again, hating to talk about the process as being overly mystical, but it's not like you're crafting this thing. It's like you're blindfolded or in a pitch dark room trying to feel out the shape of it and figure out what it is. Like, it already exists, and that's part of the faith, right? Is that this story already is a thing, but you're just trying to learn it and you're trying to discover it as opposed to crafting it. I mean, it's almost like what was it Michelangelo that said about sculpting, is he was just sort of releasing the figures from the stone. That sounds kind of artsy-fartsy, and I certainly, I don't think of myself that way, but it is how it feels, and that's why you come at it from character, then you come at it from history, you come at it from game mechanics, you come at it from location, and you start discovering the different angles of this thing until you can see the shape of it.
What comes first in that process? I mean, you sort of bring up, you know, both you and Ken, I think, clearly put a ton of research into the sort of ideas and concepts and places behind the stories you're telling, you know, whether it's American exceptionalism or Art Deco or, you know, lost cities from the Koran. There's a lot of depth that goes on there. I mean, there's a little bit of a chicken and the egg question I've always wondered, which is, you know, do you sit down and start writing descriptive text long before you start thinking about character and dialogue, or do you have situations and then try to figure out interesting places to put them? I mean, Ken, how did you start that when you were starting to think about the current work that you're doing?
I mean, I never write any descriptive text. I mean, basically what you see is what you get. I don't write anything unless it's like going in the game, because I don't care about backstory, because unless you know how you're getting it across, there's no story. Like, a lot of times we have the situation where people come in and, you know, designers will come in with some great ideas and they'll be pitching them and they'll say, well, then the player learns this. And my feeling is always that it doesn't matter what the player learns, it's what they're experiencing. And then, so, you know, I'll decide as the audience what I'm going to learn from that. I think a lot of writers are different, but I don't write any prose or backstory ever.
No, me either.
I just write the script.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only, I guess, thing that I do that would fall into that category is, in the same way that it's good to have a sounding board and maybe a writing partner, somebody that you can just kind of barf ideas at, because verbalizing things gives them shape. I'll find that sometimes when I'm trying to work something out, you know, just typing it out in the same way that I would just stream of consciousness express it to another person helps me home in on it. I hate when we have to have bios and summaries and things like that, because it's like, I'm not making that for myself. I only have to do it for marketing purposes, or, you know, right. I mean, that sounds incredibly selfish, because, I mean, people would like a little peek into what's going on in your head, but, and I've had, you know, like concept artists who, you know, want full backstories on the characters so they know when they're, you know, sketching them, maybe they can work in the backstory. It's like, I don't know. I worry about that when it seems relevant to the scene I'm writing. I'll think, well, I wonder why it would be like this, you know, and I have an inkling, but I don't like nailing any of that stuff down until I have to.
I think that's one of the problems you can get into when you get too focused on your backstory. There is a famous sci-fi trilogy that ended up having a prequel trilogy to that. And I think one of the challenges of that prequel trilogy, you know, I won't name this very, very famous sci-fi trilogy, is that I think...
I can't imagine what I'm talking about.
I think the goal of the prequel trilogy was sort of to explain everything and give the backstory, to explain what had already, people had already seen, and make them understand how it got there. And I think, you know...
But it kills it when you do that. It's like dissecting something that was alive. It's like, well, that explains how it worked. Yeah, but it's dead now.
Yeah. People want that. I think they feel they want that. But when they get that, I think they find it very unsatisfying once they get that. Because it's not what stories are about. Stories are about characters and what they want and changes they go through. They're not about how their lightsaber is constructed.
Yeah. My game director, Justin, and I were just talking about that yesterday, actually. And I never quite know what to do in terms of looking at feedback. I tend to be, maybe I'm self-punishing in some way or masochistic, but I like to read all the feedback there is out there. I like to read the reviews. I like to read all the message boards, and I try to triangulate a signal in there. But it's getting harder and harder to do, I find. I mean, that's a whole other topic we could talk about for an hour, but it is that question of like, well, do you give people what they say they want or what you think they need? And how do you take all that feedback in a way that isn't sort of poisonous and distracting and becoming just a cacophony of voices in your head and you can't hear your own internal voice that got you there in the first place?
So, Jamie, don't you think it has to be like, if that feedback shines a light on something that's been hidden, like there's a worry that you've secret, that you've had deep inside of you that you're sort of not ready to look at, sometimes that feedback can shine a light on that.
Absolutely. And there's certain writers in our medium, Michael Abbott's one, who, you know, I thanked him for an article that he wrote recently because it really helped crystallize an issue that I was having trouble actually sort of verbalizing for myself. And again, I don't mean this as pejoratively as it sounds, but it's going to come off real pejorative. It's these days, it really feels like wading through trying to find diamonds. And I've been waiting. I've got my waders on, you know, and I've found a few diamonds. But at the end of the day, I'm just not even sure whether the experience is more poisonous than it is helpful anymore. And that's tough because I want the feedback.
you know, I think it's very, very helpful, like you said, because there are diamonds there.
Yeah.
It's the question is, can you stiffen your spine enough to step through it? Because, you know, the one thing that gamers, I think, when I say gamers, I include myself in a game that I'm not working on. We never know the thing that we're going to want before we see it, you know, like in a franchise. Like, you know, people tend to know they want repeats of the experience that they've already had.
Mm-hmm.
And because that's natural. And I'm, you know, I'm not separating any gamer from myself here. I'm the same way. And then when, you know, when I'll see something like Uncharted, like the first time, I'll be like, oh, you know, but that's not what I expect out of Naughty Dog. I kind of want more of the experience I've had before.
Mm-hmm.
And then I play it. You know, first I see it on Game Informer cover. I'm like, oh, it's just some guy running around. That's not what I expect out of Naughty Dog.
Some awesome guy.
Yeah. But then you play it and you're like, oh my God, I had no idea this is exactly what I wanted from those guys. I couldn't imagine them doing anything more than I would want. But it has to come through the experience of that. But people tend to want, until they really get the experience, they tend to want the things they've seen before. And if you don't sort of fight against that stream, then you do the same thing over and over again, and there never is an Uncharted.
Right. Well, it's sort of like, you know, the ideal in storytelling is that, you know, you give them exactly what they want, but in an unexpected way. In a way they didn't know they wanted it, but it sort of gives the reader or the viewer sort of this cathartic effect of being both surprised and satisfied at the same time. And, of course, that's always our goal. But yeah, and it's interesting because I'm now having worked on a couple of series over multiple games, there's something wonderful about the first one because nobody knows what you're doing, and so you don't have a lot of dissenting voices rattling around in your head. You've just kind of got the pure act of discovery and creation on your own, and I find that in some ways I'm proudest of the first iterations in the series that I've worked on, and I think they're the purest. And then with each iteration, something gets a little janked, you know? Yeah. And I don't know whether it's because we're sort of so consciously trying to change it up, but then maybe we pick the wrong things to change, or suddenly you've got a lot of people with opinions that sort of intrude onto that purity of creation, whether it's your audience, your fans, management, the publisher, your teammates. It's real hard to know when you're in the thick of it, objectively, what those good decisions are, you know, because you want to be as inclusive as possible. But it is hard to hold on to the thing of the thing, you know what I mean? The core of it with each iteration.
You know, there's sort of two rules we have. When you're doing a new thing, it's sort of like you're the astronaut going into space. But gamers sort of don't, they never know they want you to be the astronaut. The rewards of that exploration are going to be really unclear. You know, you may come back with nothing. So they sort of want you to be the tourist, showing them new corners of the thing you've already built for them. But, you know, at the end of the day, that doesn't excite them as much. And I think what you're saying, I mean, I don't think it excites, it's not as rewarding to work on as well. You sort of have a lot of the questions answered already.
Yeah, well, it's not as exciting because, you know, it's you're trying to give yourself new challenges, but sometimes those new challenges might stray from the core of the original idea, which was purer in some way, especially when those changes, you know, are coming from outside sources. And you know, it's just hard to judge in the moment. You know, I think what people don't realize, and how do you really explain, is like how difficult development is. And that, you know, world's tiniest violin here I'm playing, right? We're very lucky to have the jobs we have, and I think we all feel blessed. It's what I mean is so much of what we do by necessity is compromise and adapting and trying to make the best decisions that we can. And sometimes that's coming out of exhaustion. The worst word you can ever see about your work or anybody else's in a creative medium is lazy.
Yeah.
I hate seeing that word because somebody, I mean, even people that are making the crappiest crap worked their asses off on that crap. Everyone goes in with their hearts on their sleeve and wanting to do the best work they possibly can. And sometimes, you know, you're sort of buffeted by things that you can't control.
I don't think there's any team worth their salt that is ever actually lazy in the traditional definition. I think what probably people perceive as laziness is when people stop taking risks. And I think that is a challenge we always face because, you know, you get into things that you're very comfortable with and that you've done before. And those are great because you know they work and you've already ironed out the kinks of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you take on new stuff. And listen, more often than not, when you take on new stuff, you get to a point and you realize that it's just not going to work. You know, like you have to throw out so much stuff.
And I've said this before as well, is that it's like, you know, we don't have a game plan that's going to have any sort of guaranteed success to it. Our iterations don't always end up with a solution that's airtight. It's usually we're experimenting. And so all I want to be doing is moving the ball down the field with whatever it is we as a medium are trying to figure out. But that means it's going to be imperfect. And then to be sort of judged harshly on those imperfections when it might have been easier not to try, it's going to be hard to swallow sometimes.
It's interesting. I mean, you guys have both been talking about that sort of player experience of being in a familiar place, right? I mean, you know, Ken, you were talking about not knowing you necessarily wanted to be Nathan Drake until you were in his shoes experiencing that story. And then all of a sudden, that was cool and that was awesome. Do you worry at all about that sense of entitlement as you go through franchises, whether they're literal continuations and sequels or whether they're just sort of spiritual continuations and you get known for a certain style of game? How much do you listen to that sort of gamer entitlement voice of, well, they're coming to expect that, we have to give them at least this much of it? Or do you deliberately try to block that out?
I think you have to try to block it out. You have to hear it. You have to see the feedback. Because I think if you just put the blinders on and ignore it, I don't know. Some people say they don't read anything, and I don't think that's wise. But somehow then you have to be able to shift into a different mode where you can still sort of dial into your own internal voice and your own judgment. You know, and there is a lot of talk about sort of entitlement in among gamers in our fan base. And, you know, you get that sometimes and feel like, I think it has more to do with sort of the hyperbolic language that people use more than an actual sense of entitlement. It'd be interesting to see what you think, Ken, especially with all this stuff around, say, Mass Effect 3 and stuff that's kind of been in the news.
I think that even if you feel that way, even if one was to say, well, I think gamers are entitled, I mean, getting upset about it or worrying about it is kind of silly because you're not going to change it. So you really have to try to be an adult and say, okay, well, this is the way the world works. This is the way a certain set of gamers is going to be. And I'm never going to change that. Well, my job is then to say, okay, what's useful to take out of it? How can I leverage that to make the games better? Because that's what, you know, I think our job is always to do is say, how can we do our job better? And is there anything in that quote entitlement that is actually pointing me in a good direction? The last thing I'm going to get into a debate with the gamer, because, you know, my view is that the customer's always right in the sense that I'm not going to get in a debate with them. It's their money. And, you know, they're entitled to feel however they feel. It's a lot of money that they're spending on what we do.
Absolutely.
And they're entitled to have a very, very strong opinion. Now, I'm, as a person on the creative end, have a responsibility to only be swayed by that opinion to the level wherein I think is right for the product and to keep my emotions. And I think that's really the hard line to walk is how do you separate your emotions? Because look, people are often attacking us, you know, personally. Sometimes you get personal, like very, very personal attacks. Like, you know, I said the Mass Effect thing, like I was on a panel this weekend and I commented on the Mass Effect thing in sort of an offhand manner because I haven't really, frankly, had enough time to form a deep opinion on it.
Yeah, same here.
And the amount of tweets I got from people about my offhand comment, it's mind-boggling. And the amount of passion. And I think they feel that to some degree, when they heard me say anything about it, they had assumed that I was making some kind of pronouncement from the Hill about the situation. And frankly, I love the BioWare guys. I love Mass Effect, but I got bigger problems to worry about right now in terms of what I'm doing day to day than sort of parsing out this sort of complex moral landscape of this relationship between consumers and Mass Effect 3. But I got all these incredibly passionate tweets about it. And that's one of the areas where I have to say, you know, the sense of gamer passion has nothing to do with my job right now. And so I'm not even though people calling me names and this, because I said this offhand comment, it just has nothing to do with what I'm doing professionally. So I just basically put it aside because it's not relevant. But then somebody will see something about, you know, something they see in the game I'm working on, and that I'll have to take more seriously. And sometimes, you know, like let's go back to Bioshock 1. When people found out that you couldn't just shoot the little sisters, there was sort of this massive outrage from gamers that you couldn't shoot little sisters. The only way you could interact with them was this harvest save mechanic. And people got super, super angry and super upset. And so, you know, you're talking down to us. And that was one of the cases where I had to basically ignore that feedback because I felt if they had what they wanted, it would not be the right experience. It would turn into a different experience, right? And we wouldn't get the message across. There are other times where I hear feedback, like for instance about like the ending of Bioshock 1, where I think that it's incredibly valid. Mm-hmm. You know, and I go away, I say, okay, well, they're not going to tell me how to fix anything because that's not their job. Their job is to tell me they're unhappy about something.
And if you hear the same note over and over and over, there's something there, but the challenge is to be able to interpret what it is that you're saying because people may not have necessarily articulated what it is exactly that bothered them. you have to have the wisdom to be able to kind of say, well, I'm seeing something similar from all of these sources, from all these players. I think I know what they're talking about. But if you take it literally, then you're just going to drive yourself crazy.
And I think Amy's right. I think that's really the job of the creative director at the end of the day, is to be an editor. And, you know, both the ideas that you come up with, the idea the team comes up with, and what you're hearing in terms of feedback from, whether it's some, you know, executive at the company or some guy commenting or whatever it is, or your wife or whoever, you know, your job is to basically take all this feedback and say, what am I hearing here? Is there anything valid? And if there's anything valid, what should I do about it? And I think that is a lot of our job, is editing ideas, editing feedback, and then figuring out what affects the product.
Some people that aspire to what our job is probably don't understand what it is. And then I've said that to lots of folks and over the course of my career, is that just know that what it's about is giving up more and more control. You don't get more and more control, not if you're going to do the job well. It's being able to step back and let other people run with things and just having the lightest hold on the reins possible.
Most people think the job of the creative director is coming up with a great game idea. And that's like such a small, small, tiny part of it. Because there is no great game idea short of execution. You know, it's all about how you execute. You can have the stupidest idea. You know, if I was to describe Katamari Damacy to you, you know, as an idea, you'd be like, what the fuck are you talking about? But, you know, they execute well. You know, if I was to describe any one of my games, one of any Amy's games, if you could just describe it in like a sentence, it might not sound like much, but it's a question of execution. And so I constantly get, you know, tweets saying, hey, how do I become a creative director? I have a great game idea. And it's so irrelevant. There's no such thing as a great game idea.
No, it's all execution. And that execution is also a collaborative effort. Those ideas that make up the whole game aren't necessarily coming from you. You have to be the judge that says, that's brilliant, let's do that. And then let's make sure we actually pull it off and have the right philosophy that we are iterating on our work, and we're willing to throw stuff away. We're willing to change things very late in the game beyond when it's sort of rational to do so on the schedule, to try to dial it in. I mean, I don't know what your experience has been, Ken, but people are always surprised when I say that we often don't know until, I don't know, the last month of development, whether A, we're even going to finish, and B, is it going to be any good? And sometimes not until you're shipping it. It's like this thing made up of little islands and pieces that you can't see the whole of until they start to sort of converge. And then suddenly, in those last couple of weeks or last few weeks, the team can see what they've been making this whole time.
It sounds like our processes, Amy, are very, very similar. And I think there are probably people who are a lot more buttoned down and a lot more organized. But the good thing about our process is I think it yields very good results. I think the bad thing about our process is that the people who are signing the checks, you can absolutely terrify them because, you know, they're coming in. It's so, you know, they're like, well, you're supposed to be in alpha, you're supposed to be in beta, and there's an expectation of what that is. You know, the problem I often get is, you know, people think that we've been working on the game for 6 months, you know, back in the beginning, they say, well, where's your story? And I'm like, dude, you know, hold your breath, because, you know, it's going to be a long time.
Or don't hold your breath.
let me solve a lot of my problems, maybe, if they did. You know, because I think people, that's something people tune into more, because people, especially people who aren't game developers, tune into things like story, and they think that's a starting point. And it comes so late. And when I say it comes, there are elements, and you have to build, it's iterative. But until you have all the sort of puzzle pieces figured out, boy, is that late, late in the process.
Yeah, for me too. And maybe there are people that do it other ways and they do it successfully, but it seems to me in the same way that trying to map out the schedule of your project on the Gantt chart is a pointless exercise, I think trying to map out the story in detail as a finished script, like you would for a film, ahead of time is the same pointless exercise, because it is anathema to what we actually do when we're making a game, which is adapting and adapting and adapting all the time to discoveries. You know, the story's no different from anything else in that regard, is, you know, we're figuring out the game mechanics as we go, we're figuring out the levels as we go, things like that.
I wanted to explore this idea that you've both talked a little bit about, sort of the player experience, right? Not having to sort of get out of your own head a little bit to think about the player, whether it's a player on a message board expressing their excitement or their disillusionment or whatever it might be. I was thinking about having this conversation with you guys, and I was realizing we're all kind of in the same age bracket, if you will. But I think about the people who play games that I play games with on a regular basis, and they range to people who are 20 to 25 years younger than I am, to folks who I know in their 60s that can kick my butt in Call of Duty. And that's such a huge range of, I mean, it's really three whole generations of people. And you're trying to build not only sort of a fun gameplay experience, but to tell stories that's going to resonate with that big an audience. How do you proxy the reader, if you will, in that sense? How do you proxy the different kinds of gamers that are going to be showing up to experience your story?
I don't think you can, because if you try, then it becomes a cynical exercise in sort of trying to design your game or your story or the experience around your demographic. And ultimately, you just have to make the game or story or whatever that you want to play. And whether, like me, you're a 47-year-old woman and not quite the target demographic or whatever, the point is that hopefully your experience is universal, and then the genuineness or the authenticity that you're trying to bring to it as the person that you are will come through and will resonate with anybody of any age, gender, ethnicity. And thankfully, that's honestly what we've found with Uncharted. We have an incredibly wide demographic. We get fan mail from women in their 60s and down to young kids, probably too young to be playing it, and from all over the world. And I think it's just because we're just approaching it from character and sort of human experience, which is universal, and not trying to engineer it to somehow magically appeal to some demographic that we think we want their money.
I think Amy's completely right in the sense that if you start from a demographic survey, I think you're in a bad place. But if you start from, and I think something that unites the games that we work on is both games are trying to, are less interested in sort of this huge world-shaking end story and more interested in the impact that larger story has on the individual characters going through it.
If we're doing our jobs well, right, we should be telling it as a character-driven story and not as a plot-driven story. Primarily.
Exactly. And that, I think people in old, you know, in the older demographic are not very interested in lore, but people of every age are interested in characters. Certainly, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about any demographic because I'm confident that if you tell a character-driven story that you buy into, that there are universal things about characters. You know, go back and read Greek plays and people were pretty much the same, you know, back then than they are now. And it doesn't really change. There are, the forms change. You know, you go back and you watch, you know, the Philadelphia Story or something, and the form has changed in movies. You know, it's a little, it was a little more arch back then and a little more what we would say is artificial. But generally, the stories, they're all the same. You know, they're about people wanting things and what they have to go through to get them.
Yeah. And, you know, of course, since this is a group effort, it's all tempered by everybody's personality and likes on the team. Yes, I'm a 47-year-old woman, but I work with a lot of guys in their 20s, you know. And so even if I was going to steer it too wrong one way, they'd probably kind of correct me. It'd be auto-correcting to some degree that, you know, we have a demographic mix right here on the team in the office. On the other hand, I think maybe some of that surprising appeal from what you create can come from the fact that you are coming from a different place than a lot of your audience. And just as you said, that part of what we're trying to do is surprise people with liking something they didn't expect to like. Maybe some of that's coming from the fact that, you know, you are drawing from experiences and sources that, you know, your 20-something male demographic doesn't know about.
You look at something like The Matrix, you know, that took this very hardcore nerdy thing called cyberpunk. And what they did is they said, well, forget about cyberpunk, forget about the lore of cyberpunk. What is universally appealing about this experience? And obviously, you know, they tapped into the fantasy of having all these abilities that you didn't have before, the fantasy of being a different person, of having a mundane life and having your life changed in a moment. And I think that's why that movie was so hyper successful, not because it dug into the lore, which was perfectly great lore in that world, but because it sort of focused on this aspirational experience. Certainly Uncharted, you know, taps into that. I mean, who would not want to be Nathan Drake? I think probably a lot of women would want to be Nathan Drake. I mean, or any one of those characters, you know, Chloe or whoever. I think they're all very appealing characters. But I think the most appealing thing, and I don't know if this is your intention, Amy, is that I wish I had a group of friends like that. You know, these funny, charming group of people who, you know, could have these experiences together and be drawn more closely by that experience. That's an incredibly powerful fantasy, despite all the sort of, you know, the deeper fantasy, you know, of archaeology and pyramids and, you know, ancient temples and all that stuff. I think it's that group of friends that really draws me to that experience.
I agree. And that's why I think no matter what we do, that's sort of the core of our franchise is the affection for the characters and, you know, huge props to the actors. Like you said in the beginning, yeah, we have to give them words on a page and we have to create an environment within which they're able to create these characters themselves and evoke these feelings for the audience. It has to be your ethic, right? But that's what I get over and over from our fans is that, you know, even if they don't agree with a certain decision in terms of mechanics or layout or a set piece or something like that, the affection for the characters is fairly universal. And I think that that's what brings people back. And it's funny, we went to a talk quite a while ago with Carlton Cuse and Damon Lindelof of Lost. And that question came up of like, you know, why does your show have such a wide demographic appeal, going back to kind of the last topic? And they said the same thing, is that we're telling a character-driven story. It's not just some sort of sci-fi story that maybe would appeal to a much narrower demographic. The point is that even if people lost the plot on a show like that, they kept coming back because they had such affection for those characters. And I think you get that right, and a lot of other stuff falls by the wayside, or you'll be forgiven for a lot of other things. You know, not that you should forgive yourself or take shortcuts, but it has to be the most important thing.
Yeah, I think if you're making a Call of Duty game, which is not as character-oriented, you have to really mind your P's and Q's and your mechanics way more tightly, because if you don't get that stuff right, then people are sort of saying, okay, well, you know, why exactly am I here?
Right.
And where I think a more character-driven piece, you know, you're forgiven a lot more for your sins as a game developer, you know, as a systems maker than you would be otherwise.
Yeah, and honestly, I also find that for me creatively, you know, when I talk about being in the pitch black room and trying to feel out the shape of the thing, you come at it from history and you come at it from locations and game mechanics. But ultimately, the thing that ends up inspiring the most is when I sort of come up with an emotional hook that I relate to with the characters. And even some of that stuff, I mean, I might not ever make explicit in the story unless I think it's important, but it somehow guides and colors everything else that I'm looking at to see if there's parallels in, you know, what I'm thinking about for the characters, and then somehow parallels something in a documentary I saw or a some sort of historical character or something like that in their biography. So not only do I think it's kind of the thing that has maybe the most appeal to the audience in some ways, but it's also the most inspiring thing for me that sort of keeps my hand on the rudder, if that makes sense.
Sounds like our process is so similar. Let's get together the next time opportunity we have.
I know. There's actually a million things I'd love to compare notes on, even related to some of Julian's questions. I probably have pages and pages of notes of my own just sort of thinking this stuff out. And so much that I'm trying to think through, I think you are as well. And it'd be great to compare notes.
Well, super. Thanks very much for the time, everyone.
Thank you very much, and I'll talk to you soon, okay?
All right. Thanks, guys.
This podcast was produced by Jim Bonney, Julian Murdoch, and Elena Signum, and edited by Ampere Audio. Music by The Happy Hollows.